everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another exploration into topics that really are profound and have a huge impact and influence on your life. And as always, it's a pleasure having you join me. And I certainly want to remind everyone who is listening, especially for new listeners, that I have a very educational website, and you're all welcome to go up there, opt in, get my special reports, and also go over and like me on my Facebook page, because I post on a daily basis some really informative information, sometimes just fun things that I find. So it's always about getting educated. It's always about expanding our minds, about having that openness to seek the truth. And as I always like to say, it's getting empowered with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. Well, today we're going to have a conversation that is very mind-expanding, and it's going to allow us to delve more deeply into a topic that has become extremely controversial. I have done several shows recently from various angles on this topic, and I'm talking about lifting the veil on vaccine dangers, the vaccine industry, and the risks to our health. And to help us navigate into this murky world of vaccinations, and certainly a world that emotes such emotional response, I have a very special guest coming all the way from New Zealand. We're really very fortunate to have with us today Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Dr. Humphreys is a real heroine in my mind. She has the courage to speak out, tell the truth, and it has not always been easy nor comfortable, but she is a woman on a mission, and I have great respect for her. So a little bit about Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. She is a conventionally educated medical doctor who was a participant in the conventional system from 1989 until 2011. During those years, she saw how often the approach fails patients and creates new diseases. Dr. Humphreys is an outspoken critic of vaccination and is a passionate educator to help people discover the true history and dangers of vaccinations. She is the author of the best-selling book, Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Suzanne Humphreys to the show today. Hello.
Hello there. Thank you for having me today.
Well, thank you for coming all the way from New Zealand. So I gather you've been living in New Zealand for a while now.
Well, yeah, I just visit here periodically.
Oh, do you go back and forth? So do you still live here in the States? And
yes, I still live in the States.
Oh, good. Well, I'm really glad you've made the time. I know it's early in the morning, but I've been looking forward to our conversation because I know you have been very busy out there in the, in the blogosphere talking about this. I've been listening to the video series that you've just put out. I think it's a 5-part video series. I've seen that it's been played over and over again in so many different areas. So you are making such a big difference, and I really appreciate the courage you have. So let me just start by asking you this very simple question, and I know we can go into it in great detail to help people understand, but we are in the midst of this vaccine war going on. I hate to call it that, but that's what it is. And as you well know, and most of my listeners know, that there are states mandating vaccinations. There are countries mandating vaccinations, such as Australia. Where's New Zealand on the mandating of vaccines these days?
Well, it's encouraged, and most people are compliant, but there are no mandates as of yet.
They're not talking about that. So I live in Oklahoma. They are looking at mandating it in the state legislature. I mean, it's a very scary time. And in fact, I have patients in Australia, and their children have been diagnosed with autism, and now they're in a very difficult situation because they have just mandated, with no exceptions, vaccines for all children in Australia, which is pretty scary, and particularly because I look at people's genes. I do nutrigenomic testing, and I can see these children who I've looked at, that they actually are very vulnerable to inflammation, have methylation issues, can't detoxify, and I can see why they've been at risk and how many of our children are like that. So I want to start out by asking you the question, what is the validity of vaccines?
Let me just start by saying that I don't think they mandated vaccines in Australia, just to be exact. What they are doing is passing legislation that people who want to have state support, and apparently a lot of people do this, it's not like a welfare program, that those people will have to have their children vaccinated, and it could be about $15,000 per child that they would lose. So it's not exactly the same as mandating, you know, for everybody.
Okay.
Regardless,
but
that's
take away
kind of
the
thin end of the wedge, I guess you could say.
Yes. So they won't be able to get their subsidies, and they probably will have their children denied to a lot of access to education or programs as well. Don't you think?
That's probably true, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I just want to start at the very beginning, because when people are discussing the issue of vaccinations, there's always this argument how important they are, they're necessary, but we never delve a little deeper into the subject, which I know you have gone into, the whole basis, the whole history of vaccines, the validity of vaccines, and I think that's where we really need to begin this conversation today.
Yes. Well, if you want me to talk in general about vaccines, or do you want to stick to the measles vaccine? It's up to you.
Let's talk in general, because I just posted on my Facebook page today a documentary that came out of Denmark that was looking at how many of these young women have been seriously injured. Their health has been compromised, and these Danish young women, and how disastrous the Gardasil vaccine is. So I think when we talk about vaccinations, even though the MMR has been really popular because of that measles outbreak, we're really talking about the whole world of vaccinations and the validity of vaccinations in general.
Okay. So in order to really, I think, understand what goes on and talk about validity of vaccination, we have to know that there's admission by, you know, anyone who manufactures vaccines and anyone who makes legislation for vaccines, that there's always a risk, inherent risk in any vaccine. And that's always been known. That's always been admitted. So the thought is that it's for the greater good of society, that if we have community immunity, that we're protecting people who can't be vaccinated, and we're decreasing the spread of disease by vaccinating. And if a few people die or become injured as a result, that's the price we pay. And they say that we have a compensation program in place, and that's how we deal with that. So everybody should be perfectly happy. Now, as far as what vaccines do and how effective they are, I think that's where we look at, are they legitimate or not? I'd also like to make it very clear that vaccines are all different. You know, some of them are for bacteria, some of them are for viruses, some of them are for toxins, and some of them contain live viruses, some of them contain pieces of bacteria, some of them just contain inactivated toxins, and some of them contain proteins and then stimulating agents to get the immune system to hyperreact towards these things that normally wouldn't be reacted towards. So when you look at it that way, I have a hard time just talking about vaccines in general. But what a vaccine is supposed to do is to prime your immune system to be able to respond to a future form of that disease, so that you will not have a full-blown clinical case, and then supposedly you will not be able to transmit that disease. Now, I'll just say right off the bat that as far as this concept of herd immunity, where those of us that are healthy need to get vaccinated, even though we would handle the disease just fine, in order to protect people who can't get vaccinated, for several of those diseases, the vaccines actually inherently in the design of the vaccine do not contain a way for that to happen. If we look at the toxoid vaccines like diphtheria and like tetanus, Those vaccines simply help your body to neutralize a toxin that is produced by the bacteria. It doesn't prevent the spread of disease at all. Okay, so those two vaccines do not promote herd immunity, even when they work 100%. If you look at vaccines that have actually just failed outright, like the pertussis vaccine, for instance, where we have the highest rate of vaccination ever for pertussis, and what we're seeing are massive increases in disease, and the governments and the scientists saying, oh yeah, you know, the vaccine really isn't working as well as we thought, and so we're going to just start giving more doses out, and still that's not working. And what's happened is, because people who are vaccinated, and this has been well established in a paper by Warfel in 2013, where he looked at baboons and purposefully infected them, either after being vaccinated or not vaccinated. It's actually the vaccinated people that are re-exposed to the disease that will harbor the bacteria asymptomatically in their lungs for up to 6 weeks. And so what happens in that and a person who has had the natural disease and convalesced will not harbor the bacteria at all in the lungs, because people who have had the natural disease develop immunity at the site of infection, i.e. in the lungs, and people who've had an injection develop their pseudo-immunity in the bloodstream and not very strongly in the lungs. So what happens is the vaccinated person will harbor that bacteria for up to 6 weeks. And so what happens when a bacteria can live in you that long, it's going to continue dividing and will mutate. And as a result of vaccines, and this is well admitted to in the medical literature, that we now have mutant strains of the bacteria that affect the immune system differently and don't contain something called pertactin. So in that sense, I think it's very clear that pertussis vaccine has done nothing for herd immunity and has actually, except in the short term. In the short term, if someone is vaccinated and the vaccine had an effect, that person will be less contagious in the short term. And that was shown in those baboons, just to be fair. But the problem with vaccinology is that people don't like to look at in the long term, and they don't like to look at the bigger picture of what these vaccines do in the rest of the body. Let's take Gardasil vaccine, for instance. I just went over a paper last night that showed, I'm trying to pull it up here, but that the Gardasil vaccine seems to be quite effective at keeping the four strains of the virus out of people who are vaccinated. Okay, so it's doing okay there. However, if we look at people who are vaccinated, what they have is a much higher prevalence of non-vaccine high-risk viral types than the unvaccinated people, 61.5% in those that are vaccinated versus 39.7% in those that aren't vaccinated. So the vaccinated are actually at higher risk for those particular types. So the answer, and this is a repeat rerun in history, is the answer is now that they have a new Gardasil vaccine that has 9 types in it rather than 4 types. And this is going to go on and on and on. And this is what happens with the bacterial vaccines, the pneumococcal vaccines as well, because it's just how nature works, where when you kill off, you know, certain strains in a body, the other strains will take over, because we don't have microbial vacuums in our bodies. We're meant to you know, have certain things circulating over our mucous membranes from time to time. And human papillomavirus is ubiquitous. Babies are sometimes born with it. Children get it from their parents. We pass it to each other. Even the types that cause cervical dysplasia, or I should say that are associated with cervical dysplasia, they often find in tonsils that are removed from children. So that vaccine, while it can be, we can say, you know, the vaccinologist will say, oh yes, it's a very valid look. You know, we're showing that there is a decrease in carriage of these particular strains, so this is great. But what they're not going to necessarily tell you is that there's almost a 2 times increase in the non-vaccine types that carry high risk.
So is
the vaccine
mean?
Valid? I ask you that. Is that vaccine valid?
So what does that mean? Can you just interpret that for those of us who don't quite understand the terminology? With 2 times more of
they looked at 592 adult women, 20 to 26, who had had all their information on HBV prevalence and their vaccination status, okay? And what they found was that 61.5% of those that were vaccinated carried the high-risk strains. 39.7% of those who were not vaccinated carried those high-risk strains. And you have to remember that the nature of HPV and cervical dysplasia is one that HPV comes and goes through cells. If you just wait long enough, more than 95% of people infected, the HPV will be gone and this dysplasia will resolve if you have a healthy cellular immune system. And that cervical lesions, in general, this is not always the case because there's always going to be somebody who says, I know someone so-and-so who had an aggressive cervical cancer lesion and had to have chemotherapy and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that might happen. But the majority of people with cervical lesions are extremely slow growing and can be caught through pap smears. So, again, I think that this makes this vaccine in a society where pap smears exist to be not a good idea.
You know, in this documentary, have you seen this Danish documentary that just came out?
Or has I think I saw the trailer for it.
They would say, first of all, I think there are something like 30,000 women who have been seriously compromised their health. I mean, serious brain inflammation. I mean, they've just been debilitated, young women who've had these vaccines. And the other interesting thing was that the average age when someone would have been diagnosed and possibly died was around 30. And now they're seeing that after this vaccination has come into existence, women as young as 20 are dying of cervical cancer, which is kind of an interesting correlation. Why are these women getting so sick? What do you think?
First of all, they knew beforehand that if you've already carried the strain of HPV that are in the vaccines, that the vaccine actually gives you a negative efficacy. And that basically means that you're at higher risk for developing a cervical lesion. And that was shown in the original trials. So there was a suggestion that there should be a test looking for carriage of these strains before vaccinating somebody, but that was vetoed immediately, probably because it would be very expensive and the vaccine uptake would have been lowered because there's a significant portion of people that do have these strains. So what do I think is happening? Well, usually we're dealing with a child who's had a lifetime of vaccines. Everyone I've seen with a Gardasil injury have been people whose parents believed in vaccines and just really never thought about it, and they handled their childhood vaccines okay, or so they thought. And so we've got an immune system that's had a lifetime of vaccinations, as you know, this is upwards of 60 different doses over a dozen vaccines throughout the child's life, starting from in America, the first day of life, and in other countries, maybe 6 weeks of age. So we're not dealing with a pristine, non-touched immune system, if you look at it that way. So that's part of the problems. That sometimes I think it may be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Mm. Whenever these things happen and the parents realize what happened, they just turn against vaccines altogether because they say they see it for themselves and they realize that this child actually had a profound reaction. This is not just a little injection site pain or a sore arm. I mean, these girls that get knocked down by Gardasil get knocked down bad, and it lasts for years. And I've only seen a couple of them actually significantly improve. So I think that this is probably one of the worst vaccines on the market, just for that reason, is that what happens, there have been reported deaths, there have been pathology studies showing that the protein from the vaccine still attached to aluminum is found in blood vessels in the brain and is a likely cause of autoimmune disease in the brain. This has been, shown by Canadian scientists, and there's another one in America that's shown that there are DNA fragments still in the vaccine that were not listed on the insert. But the way this vaccine works is that there's a protein of the HPV attached to aluminum, and aluminum is a known stimulant of the immune system, and it pretty much rocks up the Th2 arm of the immune system, which is one that can have a tendency to provoke allergic reactions. It's not the arm of the immune system, Th1, that you normally want to respond if you have a natural infection, the cell-mediated immune system. So what happens is when you inject aluminum into a muscle, you create damage in the muscle, and then the immune system reacts to the damage in the muscle. And when it comes in, it encounters all this aluminum. So the macrophages take in the aluminum. The macrophages are immune cells, and they pretty much eat the aluminum until they explode. And the explosion of the macrophages actually calls in more inflammatory mediators, and you basically create a bonfire on that site that gets continued throughout the body. And then the aluminum can then be carried into the brain and other places. But that happens with any vaccine that has aluminum. But Gardasil is special in that the way the aluminum is bonded onto that protein is like nothing we've ever seen before in vaccinology. It's very tightly bound, and it doesn't dissociate easily. So that means that not only does the aluminum stick around in the body like in any vaccine, but that this protein actually sticks around for quite a long time as well. So that's one of the problems with that vaccine. And so in my opinion, what I'm seeing in these young women that are vaccinated are syndromes that there's usually a lot of nausea, a lot of dizziness, a lot of weakness. I call it vasomotor instability. You know, normally when our blood pressures drop and we stand up, we have an increase in our pulse rate and vasoconstriction. But these girls can't regulate their pulse and their blood pressure the way a normal, healthy person would. And so that's been a big problem. They're extremely fatigued and tired. And those are actually the survivors, the ones that, you know, I think have some hope. And I've seen other cases where, you know, the girls either die or they're dealing with, you know, paralysis, being in wheelchairs, really severe neurologic diseases. And I just, you know, when I see one of these injuries, I just facepalm, because I know how much work the parents and that child is going to have to do to have any improvement in their lives. But the biggest problem is that they usually, because they've believed in the medical system and they have, you know, have always gone to doctors and done every gold standard and been good patients, quote unquote, is that when the child doesn't feel well, they're going to take this child to the doctor. And doctors will immediately say, and this is not my theory, this is my experience, that when these parents take the kids to the doctor and they suggest that it could have been the vaccine, after the first dose, the second dose, then the third dose, and even 1 or 2 years later when symptoms persist, they say absolutely has nothing to do with the vaccine. And they respond very rapidly and fervently. So they first convince the parents that the vaccine had nothing to do with what's happening. And then they start to treat the child as if they have a disease that's unrelated, and then they use their normal treatments. And I'm just going to give you an example of somebody that I've seen lately. And this girl was brought to the hospital with, you know, neurologic disorder, and they scanned her brain and they found that part of her brain was swollen. And they said, oh, you know, you've got this, and this is similar to multiple sclerosis. And so what we're going to do is put a large catheter into your neck. We're going to give you something like dialysis. It's called plasmapheresis, where we're going to remove antibodies from your system. And they did that, and it didn't work. And then they said, well, now we need to give you chemotherapy. And of course, the parents and the child are like, okay, if it'll help, please do it. And it didn't work. And then they immunosuppressed her because of the chemotherapy. And then she developed chickenpox, even though she had had 2 chickenpox vaccines in her life and actually had clinical chickenpox afterwards. She developed a case of chickenpox while she was immunosuppressed. So there was a big panic about treating her for that. And so the problem is that the system has a hammer and nail approach and basically said, oh, you have MS, we're going to treat you like MS, where the fact of the matter is that these Gardasil, you know, girls are having MS-like syndromes that is not necessarily MS, and it doesn't respond. So they're doing all these toxics. It's absolute insult to injury. In fact, I'd say it's injury to insult, actually, because what they do afterwards is sometimes just so invasive and carries long-term problems that, you know, I just can't believe that somebody could, A, survive Gardasil and then survive plasmapheresis and chemotherapy. And, you know, the girl that I'm talking about is actually fortunately, because her mother caught on to the issue, and so many of the drugs that she was given that were actually adding symptoms to what she already had were discontinued, that she's starting to do a little better now that they found some alternative practitioners that are, you know, helping her with nutrition and detoxification. But man, if these families don't look elsewhere outside the medical system in general, they don't get help. They just continue to get worse because they're getting, you know, medical system treatments for something that the doctors don't actually understand is happening or deny is happening.
So these girls get so injured and they have chronic autoimmune responses, you know, the inflammation, it's debilitating. If they don't understand the connection, they go back to their doctors, what you're saying, and then they become guinea pigs in this kind of nondescriptive, debilitating condition, and the doctors go in and try things that are very invasive, very toxic, but really don't have a rationale for what they're doing and not at all successful with these very toxic, dangerous treatments. So these girls get worse.
Pretty much. I mean, there's been, you know, one drug called Mitodrine that seems to be helpful for the, you know, the blood pressure instability. But again, that's not a cure. That's a symptom relief. But so far, that's really been the only, you know, allopathic intervention I've seen that's made a positive difference that the parents are glad for. And, you know, this is one of the reasons I left conventional medicine. I mean, I still have my license and I still practice, but I couldn't practice within the constraints of the system because you know, the tools that we had to offer and that were sanctioned and approved of, didn't help with what was happening in my office a lot of the time, and B, were toxic. And I actually didn't know anything different to do. So it was very depressing and very ungratifying, you know, to have graduated medical school and be called a doctor and be unable to help people. And I know that it must be really frustrating for doctors when this happens. The problem I have with doctors is that when the parents are sitting there saying, look, you know, this is what I saw. And these doctors have been absolutely brainwashed by their medical schools and by, you know, when they have to go take their board examinations and get their continuing medical education credits, and their part of that training is basically going through a teaching program where they're reinforcing that Gardasil doesn't have side effects, and that all these parents that are going to come to you are seeking money, and that the girls are hysterical and the parents have Munchausens, and the doctors don't know that they shouldn't trust everything that they're taught by the system. And it's, you know, most doctors need to believe in the system that they work in and that they were taught in. And so there you have, you know, that's, in my opinion, the crux of the problem. And that's why parents really need to look outside of the conventional medical system if the child is stable enough. I mean, if the child is unstable and, you know, is really deteriorating, then maybe the system has something to offer. But if she's stable and at home, I can tell you that pharmaceutical drugs that are going to be added. Let me just give you another example. One of the girls I just recently saw had lots of nausea and abdominal pain. And so the treatment, this is a drug that's not used in America yet. It's called domperidone. And it's a lactation drug because it blocks dopamine receptors and increases prolactin. And that's the only way I've ever seen this drug used, actually, was to help with lactation. So they put her on this drug for her stomach issues. And when I saw her, I said, you know, this is interesting. Because this is, as far as I know, it's just a lactation drug. And the mother looked at me and said, she's lactating, and we haven't been able to figure out why. So not only did the doctors prescribe a lactation drug, but they didn't tell her what the side effects were. And so a message to parents is, if you're going to take a drug from a doctor, in today's age, there's no excuse not to go on and Google the drug name and side effects and look at it. Because you'll get, you know, conventional pharmacology websites that'll tell you the side effects, because you're not going to be necessarily told everything. So they stopped the drug because it wasn't helping her stomach, and her lactation stopped. So this is just the kind of weird stuff, you know, that happens with desperate doctors trying to help these kids that they're not going to help with these kind of drugs. You know, first of all, pharmaceutical drugs in general don't cure anything. They help with symptoms, and many of them, we are told, have to be taken for life, you know, for like blood pressure drugs, for instance. You know, so if you're looking for cure, in general, pharmaceutical drugs are not where you're going to find that.
So this is a good moment. We need to take a break. And when we come back, I would like you to share more of your insights, because there are so many vaccines that they're pushing, but I'd like us to look at vaccines that are being prescribed for the elderly, the shingles vaccines and, you know, whatever else may be coming down the pike, and I'd like your thoughts about that. So we have lots to talk about. We are having this really important conversation with Dr. Susanna Humphreys, author of the book Dissolving Illusions, Disease, Vaccines, and the Forgotten History. And don't go away, because we have a lot more to discuss. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and you are listening to What Women Must Know. Hi, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we are talking with Dr. Susanna Humphreys, all the way from New Zealand. And Dr. Humphreys has really been a very powerful voice of sanity, helping us to understand the real issues regarding vaccinations and the risks and the untold risks. We're talking about Gardasil right now. Dr. Humphreys, I wanted to ask you, in your experience, by the way, there are tens of thousands of young girls who have been harmed from Gardasil. I mean, thousands, tens and tens of thousands. This isn't just an occasional occurrence. Is this getting attention by the authorities? Is this being questioned by how this vaccine is being used? Is there any, you know, are there consequences in the medical world about the Gardasil vaccine, or are we just kind of, you know, just like blind to this whole situation?
Well, let me ask you, do you ever turn on TV and just watch regular television?
I actually don't. Well, I don't have a TV.
I know. I don't either. Most of the television I saw was at the bedside in the hospital, but my understanding is that there's very little coverage of any problem with any vaccine in mainstream media, and that any such coverage is discouraged. And that, you know, that there's, you know, Kathleen Sebelius of the United States Public Health basically put out a bulletin several years ago saying to keep anybody with an anti-vaccine sentiment out of the media. And that has pretty much been adhered to. I mean, if you watch any kind of show, actually, let's just take, who was it that covered the vaccine recently? It was
Robert Kennedy Jr.
It was a mainstream TV. Katie Couric covered this. And she did have Diane Harper on, which was unusual, because and I won't call Diane Harper an anti-vaccine doctor, because she's not. She's actually a pro-vaccine doctor who was involved in some of the clinical trials for the Gardasil vaccine, and woke up in the middle of the night one evening and said, something's not right here, and I can't continue on the path that I'm on, and I'm going to start to talk about the problems I see with how this vaccine is being advertised as highly effective and safe. And she just is now speaking more publicly. So, you know, Google Diane Harper. So she was a doctor who had, you know, something negative to say about the vaccine, although she's not completely negative about it. Certainly she doesn't sound like I do. But that was about all we saw. And the backlash that happened after that show, you know, between the pro-vaccine, quote, science bloggers, unquote, and, you know, just the attacking of any parent who spoke out during that show or after that show about their vaccine-injured child. These parents are attacked. They're attacked publicly, verbally, for so much as suggesting that's vaccine-injured their child. Even the ones who have dead children are told that they're creating fear where fear doesn't belong. So this is the kind of stuff that we see on mainstream, if it's even allowed on mainstream. But I can tell you that if there, you know, we have the vaccine adverse event reporting system, and an organization called SaneVax, S-A-N-E-V-A-X, which if anyone has questions, really ought to go and go to that website and look around, because these people have really taken on the issue with HPV. And, you know, they've got expert medical opinions, and they've got parents, some of whom, you know, one is a cardiologist father who has been speaking out against it after his daughter was injured severely by the vaccine. But if you just look at the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System data, what you will find is that if all vaccines were created equal, that the HPV vaccine would be represented by 7%, being one of the 14s in the group of that have caused injuries. And the vaccine has caused more injuries than all of the other vaccines put together, according to the vaccine injury graphs. You know, if we look at if we look at abortions and chlamydia infections and infertility and disability, I'm looking at the graph right now, extended hospital stays, those things all amount higher than all other vaccine injury reports combined. And there's a graph on SaneVax site that shows this image that I'm looking at right now and telling you about. So the reports from this vaccine are very high. But it turns out that the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System really is like a eunuch. I mean, it doesn't do anything. It's just there for people to report because it was written into the policy of the compensation program in the late 1980s. But it doesn't necessarily mean anything, because reports are anonymous, because anybody can report. It's just basically a data system that, in my opinion, is just meant to help vaccine injured people feel better. But whenever we bring up, you know, these reports as a defense for our position, we're told, well, it's just VAERS. It's not verified. And sometimes it's underreporting, sometimes it's overreporting, and that it's not standardized data, so we can't make anything of it.
So it's pretty evident that this whole hysteria around vaccinations, which is happening worldwide, is a concerted effort. You know, that's how I see it, to push this this belief system that we have been indoctrinated with, even though it shows it can be you know, it's very ineffective, has dangers. But there's an agenda going on here, a very obvious agenda for those that can see it. Because if all dissent is denied, then you know there's some power that be that is wanting this information to be quelched. So we can just get one side of the story and push vaccines. And everyone who's concerned about vaccines is talking about how many vaccines are coming down the pike and how we're increasing the vaccines and increasing the profits of pharmaceutical companies. So I think, you know, that's a really honest assessment of what's behind all this. Do you have any comments about that?
Well, I mean, I'm watching everything happen, and you know, I started out as a doctor who prescribed vaccines. I was vaccinated myself. I was pretty much ignorant to any problems with vaccination until around 2009, when I saw some of my own patients develop kidney failure after having normal kidneys and then being placed on dialysis. So, you know, I'm not I don't call myself an activist. You know, I'm just somebody who actually saw it happen myself. And when I went to do my own investigation, I actually did that because I was met with so much resistance when I said the vaccine is the cause of this problem. You know, any other time as a nephrologist, I said, you know, the drug is the problem. Everyone said, oh, yeah, definitely, you know, we'll stop the drug. But when I suggested it was a vaccine, I was told, no, you know, the person just got influenza before the vaccine could work, and the influenza caused the kidney failure. And, you know, I just said, wait a minute, you know, how can you tell me this? This is what I saw. And influenza itself is an extremely rare cause of kidney failure. And the patient didn't have influenza symptoms. And then I was told things like, well, smallpox vaccine eradicated smallpox, and polio vaccines eradicated polio. So what's your problem? And that's really what sent me into, you know, doing my own research at that point. And since doing my own research, what I've found is that the science does not, does not support the policies and the, you know, the religious belief in vaccination that we see. So I just want to just tell you the story about measles, because I think that's a really important one, because measles today is being held as something that's worse than, you know, the Black Plague and Ebola. Literally, there are now media articles talking about how Ebola is better than measles. And so measles is being used as the tool to basically turn the vaccinators against the non-vaccinators and start to get these mandatory vaccine policies placed. So what happened in 1963 was that the public was offered a vaccine that was supposed to be a one-shot deal, and it was supposed to eradicate measles by 1967 just by giving part of the childhood vaccine, part of the childhood population, one vaccine. So they did that. The first vaccine was a killed measles vaccine, which actually was not only ineffective, but led to something called atypical measles, which was worse cases of measles if they encountered the wild virus. So that vaccine was silently and slowly pulled off the market years later, but not removed from doctors' offices after millions of children were vaccinated with it. The effects from that vaccine could last up to 16 years. At the same time, there was a rather aggressively virulent vaccine that was marketed. It was a live viral vaccine. And because it basically caused a case of measles in anyone that was given it, with very high, actually higher temperatures than measles, the temperatures could be up to 106 and very severe symptoms, that children were actually co-medicated with human immune globulin at the same time just to kind of dampen down the symptoms the vaccine would give. And it wasn't until 1968 that a better attenuated, less virulent vaccine was put on the market. And so in those years, there were big problems with the vaccine. So obviously, it turned out that the initial promise that maybe even I would have agreed to back then, if we only had to give part of the childhood population, you know, a vaccine that was supposedly attenuated, meaning tamed down for measles, and it would eradicate measles, you know, that seemed like a pretty good deal. But it turned out that it was, again, just the nose of the camel, or if we could say the thin end of the wedge, because by 1967, which was the year it was supposed to be eradicated, it was anything but eradicated. And so by the 1980s, we had a really high uptake of this vaccine. We had the MMR vaccine by then. And still, we were seeing, you know, in some cases, 20,000 cases of measles per year in the United States. And what they realized was that there was a significant percentage of children who were vaccinated who don't respond at all initially, and there was an even bigger percentage of people who between 4 and 11 years later have no immunity left in their system from the vaccine. So that's called primary and secondary failure. And so the second vaccine was added to the childhood vaccination program. So not only did everything changed from having just to vaccinate part of the childhood population with one vaccine to vaccinating 95%, or actually back then they said 80 to 90% of the childhood population with two vaccines by the time they entered kindergarten. So that was suggested, and the vaccine uptake increased once again. And What happened after that was that we had what I will call a honeymoon period, where there was a significant decrease in the outbreaks of measles in the United States, because initially, like I said earlier, these vaccines do have an effect and they can decrease the transmission of wild measles virus. But what's happening today is that the people who are truly immune, who have actually had a case of measles and have a lifetime of solid immunity, are dying out of the population. And they're being replaced by people who are vaccinated. And so what's happening is rather embarrassing, because we're seeing increase in epidemics with, you know, anywhere between 18 and 50% of people having had two vaccines in their lifetime are cases in these outbreaks. And so something had to be done, because not only are they seeing an increase in non-vaccinating populations as parents are getting more educated and as the information age is allowing us to talk to each other, that they need to cut that out, because if we start seeing more healthy children who never need antibiotics and haven't been vaccinated, more people are going to want that. So this is quite an embarrassment, because not only are we having vaccine refusers, which still amounts to a very small percentage of people in America, but we have an even higher percentage of people who have been vaccinated two or three times and are still developing measles because either the vaccine didn't work in the first place or it's worn off between 10 and 30 years later. So now the new recommendations are for all of us, for you and me, to get revaccinated with measles and to continue getting revaccinated. So we've had a program that started out with just one vaccine to part of the childhood population to now having basically, you know, cradle to grave vaccination. So so this kind of policy obviously is going to be looked at, you know, by the public as something that they might not want, because anyone who's older than 70 knows what a case of measles really is, and anybody who understands the immune system knows that any case of encephalitis or blindness is due to lack of nutrition and improper treatment of measles. So properly treated measles is actually quite easy to handle for a person in the developed world today. And we have everything we need to be able to do that. But there's all this outrage about, you know, what it's costing hospitals and that we could have encephalitis come back and people have gone blind. But this blindness thing is just, it's ridiculous. This happens in third world countries from corneal ulceration because of, you know, vitamin A deficiencies. This just doesn't need to happen in America or any developed country. Hospitals should have in place a policy that if someone has measles, they're giving 200,000 units of vitamin A twice a day. End of story. There will be no blindness. As far as encephalitis goes, these people, their cell-mediated immune system is impaired. And we know that if someone develops encephalitis, say you have a encephalitis in the population from wild measles, we know from some Finnish studies that if you vaccinate the population, you diminish the measles rate. You will diminish the specific encephalitis that comes from measles. But if you look at the total encephalitis rate in the population, it doesn't change, and the cases actually can be more severe. So what that tells you is that this is a problem with the people and not with the microbe. So you can kill off the microbe and kill off that specific brand of encephalitis, but you're not killing off encephalitis in general. So the excuse that we're giving the vaccine for encephalitis just doesn't hold water.
You know, Dr. Humphreys, the thing that gets lost in this whole conversation is that maybe we're just living in such terrifying times. There's so much fear, and we're overwhelmed with all the ways that we feel threatened and vulnerable, that we forget that we can create strong, healthy immune systems that are able to either withstand these microbes that could invade us, or at least help us to recover quickly and safely, and then have lifetime immunity from things like measles, which used to be. So there's a whole conversation and discussion that is not being addressed and acknowledged at all. And to me, it's like you're just, it's such an obvious thing that is ignored. How do we create strong, healthy immune systems in our children and in the general population with seniors, which is really the key to preventing these health challenges?
That's right. It's nutrition is so important. And as you say, we have access today to, you know, excellent nutrition, excellent information on how to support a healthy immune system. And so that's part of it. But the other part of it is that, you know, the immune system begins before you're born. And, you know, how a mother is treated by the medical system and society in general actually has a strong impact on how that baby's immune system is going to function and how that birth is going to go. So a mother who is uptight and scared during her pregnancy, especially during her delivery, could end up with a cesarean section. And cesarean sections, we know, put the baby at a disadvantage to their immune system because they don't get their first dose of probiotics that they need. And for lots of other reasons, the immune system is actually jump-started by the high level of catecholamines that happen during a normal birth. So if you don't have a normal birth, that's going to put the child's immune system at a disadvantage.
I want to jump in here because we're coming to the end, but I want to ask you this one question talking about pregnancies. What vaccines are recommended for pregnant women now?
Well, across the board, influenza vaccines are recommended in America to pregnant women. Every pregnancy, a woman is going to be offered a diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis vaccine. And then they could also be offered hepatitis A and hepatitis B vaccines. And as well as, if you go to the CDC's website, they have the whole list, but those are the major ones. And again, I've done a series on infant immunity that's on YouTube where I talk about these vaccines during pregnancy and how they affect the immune system later. And so anybody can go on and find that infant immunity video. There's a shorter version, and then there's a day-long seminar that I talk in detail about that.
Okay, and they're dangerous, bottom line, potentially to the mother and to the newborn.
I'd rather if somebody went and watched the video, because just to say, you know, they're dangerous, I'd like for people to really understand why there are problems with them and how effective they actually are or are not.
Okay, so fair enough. I think people should get educated. And in the few minutes that we have left, I want to go to the other end of our life cycle and talk about what is being recommended to seniors.
Okay. Well, seniors are also recommended to receive influenza vaccine, but the influenza vaccine that they get is not the same one as you or I would get. I mean, I'm not a senior yet. I will be soon, but I'm not yet. So the dose of the virus is higher in their vaccine, and the dose of aluminum there's no aluminum in an influenza vaccine. Forgive me. So it's the dose of virus is about four times as high in the influenza vaccine that's offered to adults because, you know, as we age, supposedly our immune systems don't respond as briskly, although I don't really believe that's a necessity. I think that's just something that happens because of nutrition and you know, attitude. So that's the major vaccine that's offered to seniors. They're also offered a 23-valent pneumococcal vaccine to supposedly prevent pneumonia. And I always made it a point whenever I was consulted on a kidney case to ask the patient who had pneumonia when I was consulting if they had their Pneumovax, and 9 times out of 10 they would say yes. And what happens is, just like with the Gardasil vaccines, and we see this happen with the childhood pneumonia vaccines, pneumovaccines as well, is that while the vaccine can be helpful in its target mission, which is to prevent colonization in that particular type, that other types move in and to fill in the void. So that's one thing that the seniors will be offered. And as you mentioned earlier, the shingles vaccines are offered to seniors, which have basically a high dose of a virus that's already in their system, the varicella virus. And you know, we hear, oh, it has a 50% effectiveness, so it's really good. But if you look at the data, you'll see that, you know, most of healthy people, normal people, have about a 3.3% risk of developing shingles, which is basically a reactivation of the chickenpox virus that can come out into the skin and through a nerve and cause a painful situation. So 3.3% of us, you know, will develop that on average. But if you're vaccinated, it'll go down to 1.6%. So that's how they get their figure of that it's 50% effective. You have to be careful about how these numbers are reported and what the true risks are. And again, it's just like with any sort of virus, that it's your cell-mediated immune system that really needs to be healthy. So if adults are getting good nutrition and they're not under stress and they're getting adequate sunlight or vitamin D and vitamin C, preferably from food, then, you know, they're going to be in good stead to keep that virus that's already in their system under control. So their own immune system will do what this vaccine is supposed to do to their immune system.
So do you think vaccinating the seniors is adding to their risk of death?
Well, I'll just say that if you look at the components in vaccines and you understand, you know, how these vaccines are cultured and incubated and what they do to the immune system, I don't believe that they're any better for seniors than they are for infants. It's just that infant immune systems are still undergoing a programming, where adult immune systems are no longer undergoing programming, but they're taking a hit. And I just think that there are better ways to deal with disease than vaccinating our seniors every year for flu and periodically for pneumonia and shingles, as if these are the only things that can affect them. When in fact, you know, most infections that are going to hit seniors, there's no vaccine for at all. So it's always the key is good nutrition and
keep their
and
vitamin D levels
keeping the
up.
Self-mediated immune system working.
Yep. Well, this has been such an important conversation. We've actually come to the end of the show. I want to be sure that people go visit you and visit your website, at least visit your website, which is Dr. Suzanne .net. Is that the best website to direct them to?
And yes, I just want to say that I co-authored the book Dissolving Illusions with Roman Bistrionic, and our website for the book is dissolvingillusions.com, and you can go there and read part of the book for free and look at the graphs for on the color graphs for free as well.
Okay, dissolvingillusions.com, and also
yes.
Your website is drsuzanne.net.
Correct.
So, thank you so much for this really informative conversation. We could have gone on a lot longer, but I know you've got many wonderful educational YouTubes, and I encourage people to go and listen to the lectures you've given to help understand this topic. It's really important that we do understand it so we make those informed decisions. Dr. Suzanne Humphries, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay, thank you very much.
And
bye.
To all of you listening, thank you for your time today. I hope you'll come back and visit again next week. And until then, remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.